My name is Dana Womack, and to my left is Judge Brian Walker, and to my right is Judge Mike Wallach. This is the W panel, as we call ourselves. Could you please call the docket?
The court will now call Robert F. Coleman, Deputy of the State of Texas. May I please report Ms. Lisa Mullen will argue for the appellant. Ms. Shelby J. White will argue for the state.
Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I guess this is the case that never ends. let me start out by addressing, I think, is one of the most interesting issues, is that in the truth of the matter, when you really look at how this case progressed, this court's original opinion remains absolutely undisturbed by the remand. Watkins does not affect in the discernment that under 3914A, materiality equals relevance, which kind of changed what we all thought. However, that has absolutely zero impact on how this case was originally held, because it wasn't under the A provision where materiality was determined. This case was determined under the H provision, Brady provision of the statute, which does not have the term materiality in it. So Watkins really has no bearing.
Do you think that the CCA was just kind of confused, or do you think that they just had a whole swath of cases that they sent back? Or why do you think we're basically have an assignment to do something, in essence,
right,
when we're looking at different provisos?
I think it started with, I raised under 3914 A provision and H provision issues and a whole bunch of them in my original brief in this court. However, this court only came back with a ruling on impeachment under H without having to deal with the other issues. But when the PDR got granted, of course, it's Watkins materiality, which there is some dicta in this court's lower opinion, this opinion, that talks about what materiality is, because it had to be addressed if we're going to address the other violations of 3914. So I think that's how everything got convoluted. They saw Watkins materiality issue, granted review, and then afterwards just sent everything back. And if you see the remand order, you could tell they kind of didn't look at it thoroughly, because they talk about it's punishment evidence that was challenged, and it really wasn't punishment evidence that was challenged. It was a guilt innocence, even though it came up at punishment. So I think they just had a swath of Watkins issues and just sent them all back.
Honest question, not a trick question.
Okay.
Are you aware of, was there a lot of these cases that got remanded throughout the state? Do you know, right after Watkins was
I would
decided?
Say there was a few, but I don't know the exact number. Because I had an opinion watch on it, and so I was getting a lot of pings, but I don't know exactly what they did, because I really didn't look at them once I saw they were just remands that came back. So that's the first thing. The original opinion, without the dicta that this court had concerning materiality in A section, trying to say it was equal to Brady, that's been changed. But it doesn't change the original holding of this court that should stay, that should stand. Additionally, when we talk about the question of the harm analysis, which I think is the issue the Court of Criminal Appeals refused to address, didn't address. And I kind of agreed with the state prosecuting attorney, if you saw their motion for rehearing in Watkins, basically said, you know, stop this rolling around of cases in eternity and just give us the answer, right? And so, gee, I wish they would have, but it was denied. In this particular case, in all candor with the court, as far as what the proper harm analysis is, the exact answer is I really don't know. There's a lot. We've got a panoply of possible issues, but what's most important for this particular case is that this court has already made a de facto finding concerning the harm under any analysis that's used, that this was harmful under even the most stringent analysis of 44.2B, because this court found substantial harm, so that de facto finding stands in this particular case. In assessing the harm, we've got a panoply of possible issues to look at. Obviously, we've got 44.2B, right, which is the most stringent. Does it affect a substantial right? The substantial right tests. And in oral argument, honestly, when I argued the case to the Court of Criminal Appeals, Judge Newell sort of tipped his hat that it would be that. It would be a statutory violation under the rules. He asked me my opinion, if I agreed with that opinion. And I did agree that under that provision, it would be if that was the actual violation. However, once we look at that, it's really sort of a distinction without a difference, although the verbiage matters to the Court of Criminal Appeals, because it's the same harm analysis. The results are the same.
If I can, under footnote 55 in Watkins,
yes,
the court notes that CUS versus Augers, noting that the significance of a particular piece of evidence can seldom be predicated accurately until the entire record is complete, and explaining that Brady materiality standard requires evaluating undisclosed evidence in the context of the entire record. So,
correct.
The harm analysis that we did in the original opinion, tell me why it either is or is not adequate.
It absolutely is adequate because there was a painstaking review of the entirety of the evidence on original opinion, and that is exactly the standard that the court used in that opinion. And if you can see it in there, in fact, I think that exact verbiage is used. It requires us to review all of the evidence together, and the court did that in its original opinion and came back with the exact same reasonably likelihood of a different outcome, which is the 44-2B standard. It's identical. And it was a finding that was made there, even though it was made under the premise of Brady materiality. So 44.2B, the most stringent test, is already met. However, not sure that's the one that might apply. I made an argument, 44.2A, the constitutional analysis, or harm review, might be the standard that we look at. I think that's a logical argument that can be made, and in fact, that issue is pending in front of the Court of Criminal Appeals right now, in that PDR was granted in a little bit different scenario, but the question is under 3823, right, the suppression statute, statutory violation, based on a constitutional violation, which applies, right? Would it be just a straight statutory 3823 violation, or do we go to the constitutional one of the A provision? So that's interesting. It's pending. Once again, who knows? But that would be the argument in application in this case, would be the constitutional error harm analysis. And once again, obviously, if we've met the most stringent level, we clearly have met that. This court has already determined that. Then you've got Brady, which is the court's analysis that was used in this case, reasonable probability that would be a different outcome. And then we've got Mosley. So when you look at all, we've got a lot of issues, but what's interesting to me, if you really want to assess the actual error, what logically makes more sense to me from a purely law standpoint is that the actual error is abuse of discretion from the denial of the mistrial, right? The state violated the Brady or the statute, right, 3914. That's the violation. But when we look at error, the error was when the judge refused to deny a mistrial, given all the circumstances based on that violation. That would lead me to sort of lean toward the Mosley factors, right? Because that's what you use as a standard of harm review in a case where that is the actual error that occurred, and that's what occurred in this case, which kind of adds more issues for the court to consider. Once again, and I think it's noted in one of the opinions, that is the same substantive test as 44.2B. So under any of the standards, any of the harmless error reviews in this particular case, the de facto decision has already been made that it's met, and it is harmful. But the denial of the state, and that single statement alone, the mother's handwritten statement, was sufficient to make the outcome unreliable or the substantial test under 44.2B. You were asking, the court did a painstaking review of all the evidence, and the harm is shown as the court delineated everything out. It was the central issue to the entire defense in the case. The defense was that the allegation was made in an effort from the mom to get the girls to talk about abuse after there was no evidence of that in the past because she was livid that her daughter wanted to go stay with the dad.
Ms. Mullen, let me, if I may, real quick.
Sure.
You know, just make the assumption that we don't have to even follow our first opinion and just pretend like we could start over from scratch. You know, the theory of the case at the trial court level was that the mom was lying and causing the daughters to lie. And,
right.
And then, of course, we're looking at most likely a reasonable likelihood of a different outcome standard is what you're saying.
Right.
You're a trial attorney. You don't just do appellate work, and I hear you're pretty good at it. So just for our own edification, listen, just back up and help me, help the court. What would you have done if you had been trial attorney and you had had this information during the guilt-innocent phase? Because the way it's been briefed is simply that it would have been outcome determinative, that it would have, that it would have changed the outcome. But how? What would that look like? I understand it's impeachment, but just
right.
Enlighten us a little bit more. What tangibly would that look like in real time in a courtroom?
Right. Okay. Tangibly, you know, obviously you cannot overstate the importance of a handwritten statement by a witness. There's all types of things that can happen when it's in a police report. She said this to me. She didn't say that to me. But when you have a handwritten statement and you have a witness who's the most important person in the case, it's your entire defense, as this was motivated by ill content in a divorce and wanting to get, the outcry came 3 days after the daughter went to stay with him. So I've got all of that I'm working with to try to show that she's got motives to lie and that she's lying under oath. Obviously, you can't underestimate that either. When you've got a witness, it's a star witness against you. And the whole motive for why these accusations are made. And she gets on the stand. The state brings in the assault charge, the extraneous. And she testifies when she starts getting pressured about, well, wait a minute, you had no idea about this. And she starts saying, no, I knew. In fact, I told that officer at that location about this assault. I told that officer, and she goes into pretty good detail. She hangs herself pretty deep on the fact I told this officer. In my opinion, that is crucial because that's somebody lying under oath and lying about the motive that the defense is raising for her to create the allegations, okay? And so my ability to take her statement then after she has explicitly lied and have her in her own handwriting never have mentioned a single word about that whatsoever is powerful. I would say pass the witness as soon as I took that statement and confronted her directly and slowly with that.
Right, and that would be the prior inconsistent statement or the lack thereof. You would actually be showing the jury you made a written statement that said everything it needed to that was probative. And it wasn't
correct. Well, first I would ask her, and I'd give her the opportunity, right, for impeachment.
True.
Very slowly get her hung on that. And then I would produce the statement if she still stayed with the lie.
And so if we were to do a quantum between what did happen and what could have happened, that would be the big difference. Is that correct? It
well,
would be being able to actually use that physical statement
yes.
to impeach and basically show the jury that we have a written record in your handwriting that and you never mentioned any of that.
Correct. That in addition to, there's two other factors there that I think are extremely important. The second one is that there's a list of domestic violence cases, because it was a domestic call, where they always ask the person, had they ever said they're going to retaliate against you? Have they ever threatened to kill you? Have there any allegations of sexual assault? All of that's in the record. And that was not disclosed, and her answer to all of those was no, which is directly contradictory to her previous testimony, okay? The third thing that is immensely wrong, that makes it highly important that we should have been given this at the time, I wasn't the trial attorney, but that they should have, is when the defense, in an effort to rebut this and try to prove that she's lying, calls the police officer that was at the scene. and the police officer at the scene of the assault testified. He is no longer with the police department. He did not have his records because they didn't provide those. All he had was a decor offense report, which we know doesn't include anything. So the prosecutor's answer to that was, well, she could have told you and you didn't remember. She could have said to you exactly that and you didn't remember. And he could have looked at that check sheet had it been discovered and said, no, I asked that specifically. She did not say that. But instead, the impression left with the jury is, oh, she said that and he didn't remember it. And even the state got him to say, it could have happened that way. I don't remember everything about it. My time's up. I'll be back.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Shelby White for the state. This is how we got here today. Mom gets on stand and testifies at trial. She testifies about the domestic violence incident, and she says that she told the officer she suspected the defendant was sexually abusing her children. In response, the defense calls that same officer to impeach Mom. He says it never happened, 2, it wouldn't have happened the way she said it did, and 3, if it did happen, I would have written it down. I think that the record is very clear. There is no wiggle in his testimony about maybe I don't remember. He says, here's my officer's report. I've got it right in front of me. This is what happened. And if it happened the way she said it would have happened, I would have written it down. I'm trained to write down if someone mentions sexual abuse. I'm trained to write that down. And I'm also trained to never go and question a child directly about sexual abuse. I don't think there's any wiggle room about that.
Let me interrupt and ask this question. Is we did a harm analysis the first time around. Why is that or is not a proper harm analysis to be utilized?
I think Watkins has changed the game completely. That has been our position. That was our position at the time that we argued before the CCA, and that's our position now. Because previously, when we were under what we thought was under Brady and the materiality standard, materiality is reviewed de novo. We obviously disagree with the court's ultimate conclusion in the previous argument, but we do still believe the court was right. When you're reviewing materiality, it is reviewed de novo. That case law is clear. The issue now is that we are under Watkins, and Watkins says 3914 as a whole, not 3914A, 3914 as a whole, including 3914H, is strictly a criminal statutory discovery scheme. It is not meant to be a constitutional provision. It is meant to be similar to a civil discovery scheme. It is meant to just lay out the ground rules for when the state is required to disclose discovery information. And so that means when we're looking at a strictly statutory violation, we're under 442B harm analysis.
Okay, under footnote 54.
Yes.
Says the state appears to agree by noting that courts conducting a statutory harm analysis will still effectively conduct a Brady materiality analysis as to that part of the analysis. We did a Brady analysis. Why is that not sufficient?
The difference is that the Brady analysis is de novo and 442B would be under an abuse of discretion standard. So the difference and the distinction now, I think, and I would agree with that footnote to the extent that when we are looking at the materiality factors, we are looking at the same factors under harmless error and we're looking at the same factors under Mosley. They're all the same, you know, a three-sided coin basically. But the difference is the deference that is due to the trial court under that. And so now when we are redoing it, we are not doing a de novo review anymore. We are owed deference to the trial court's decision. In that case, the trial court said, I've been here this whole time. I do not think that this evidence would have been material to the outcome of the trial. And so I think that in that case, now this court owes deference to the trial court's decision in that.
You would concede, though, there is kind of an added kink in that that trial judge actually hadn't been present the whole time.
That is a kink, and it's a bit unusual, but I don't think, as we mentioned in our briefing, that error has not been preserved properly because we do not know what the visiting judge's terms of assignment were. And then second, the argument that the defendant is making on is not necessarily that the argument is not that the trial judge erred in her ruling, but that the deference owed to her should be changed based on this particular scenario. And I don't think that's a good rule to craft. I don't think that you can say, well, normally we would give you due deference, but because of the way that this case turned out, we're going to suddenly review this particular case de novo, even though it normally would be abuse of discretion. I don't think you can try and wiggle your way around that and try and make different rules for different scenarios. It just needs to always be the same standard of review. And if you want to argue that the trial court erred in ruling, then you need to say she shouldn't have ruled, not that we changed the deference owed to her because of what parts of the trial she saw or didn't see.
Yeah, and it could apply. It could change how we apply the standard, the same standard. You agree with that?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying the standard needs to be the same, irrespective of if there was one trial judge throughout the whole trial,
yeah.
Or like this situation where you had three different judges for three different parts of
the standard should always
trial.
Be abuse of discretion. Yes.
Let me change back to where you started. You said something about the officer during his testimony made these concessions. Are you basically telling us that the decor had all the information in it, that what he had before him, his notes, was everything that ultimately got provided and the punishment?
So what was disclosed at trial was the offense report, which has the police officer's narrative. And what was not disclosed was a family violence packet, which also included a separate police officer narrative. And those two narratives are literally copy-paste. And so when he's reading his offense report and you try and say, oh, he would have said something different if he looked at the family violence packet, that's not true because the two narratives are literally copy-paste. I don't think that there is a sense that he would have said something different if he had seen the family violence packet. The difference, I think, is if they had the family violence packet, they would have impeached her with their handwritten statement. But our position has been that, yes, you may have been able to do that, and that impeachment might have looked a little different, but it's not, we know that the jury saw her be impeached, effectively impeached. I mean, it was pretty obvious that she was very effectively cross-examined by the defense. She kind of lied to save face, and then they slammed her with a police officer coming in, looking at his report and saying, absolutely not, that never happened. And so this idea that the jury would have heard a slightly different version of an impeachment on the same issue, and that we would have come in and said, Mom's lying, here's your handwritten statement, Mom, we know that you're lying, and that the jury would have suddenly changed their mind and flipped, I don't think that's a leap that can be made necessarily.
So in essence, I kind of asked Ms. Wallman this, if there was a quantum done between what happened and what could have happened,
yes.
You're basically telling us that the only thing that would have been different is the jury's ability to actually see that written statement,
yeah.
And in it published and say, look, here it is. And but in essence, the testimony, the theory, everything else carried through exactly the same way it would have, irrespective.
Yes, and I think what 44-2B substantial harm is that if it had no effect on the jury's verdict or a slight effect on the jury's verdict, that's not enough to overturn. And so I think we could concede there might be a slight difference, but it's not enough. When you balance the two and you look at impeachment through a police officer's testimony where he's got his report in front of him and he says, I never would have done it that way. I would have written it down if it had happened that way, and I'm specifically trained to not handle cases that way. When you compare that impeachment to the impeachment of Mom's handwritten statement, which is, and if you look at what the handwritten statement, the kind of the word for it, but when it says, please write down everything that happened in this particular offense, and she writes down about the domestic violence offense. So I think there's definitely, even if you're looking at her impeachment, she could have wiggled out of that and said, the sexual abuse of my daughters doesn't really have to do with this domestic violence incident. And so I think they presented it as the strongest possible version of an impeachment that could exist. And I think in this particular instance, when you look at the two impeachments you have, that doesn't ring true.
So how would we reconcile today this court's prior opinion with the position you're taking?
I think we reconcile because we're under a different standard of review. Because it is an abuse of discretion, it's not a de novo review anymore. And to me, that means we're not only doing it all again, but we're doing it all again with a deference to the trial court. And whether we choose to apply the Mosley factors or whether we choose to apply 44-2B, it doesn't matter. I do think that 44-2A is absolutely not applicable. 44-2A is strictly a constitutional harm standard. And Watkins makes very clear that we're not Brady anymore and we are not constitutional harm anymore. We are strictly a criminal statutory discovery scheme. And there is case law, I'll read from Watkins real quick. Article 3914H creates a statutory duty to disclose that is broader than constitutional due process obligations recognized in Brady v. Maryland. Indeed, the creation of Article 3914H is inconsistent with this court's precedent relying on the due process concept of materiality to determine whether the refusal to order disclosure amounted to harmful error. This statutory change suggests a departure from our precedent interpreting the previous version of Article 3914.
Let's go back to the concept of abusive discretion. The purpose of abusive discretion is the presumption is that the trial court can see and hear the witnesses and all the other evidence and can make a weighing decision.
Yes.
how can you take that presumption in the face of a situation where you have three different trial judges which apparently don't overlap, and one making a decision about something that somebody else heard and observed? How can you take that inherent presumption on abuse of discretion and apply it to this circumstance?
I think that is a wrinkle in the particular facts of this case, but I think the problem is you cannot, when we're looking at this case and thinking about what rule are we crafting for the future, how does this apply in the future, you cannot say, in this particular case, because this judge, she sat through all of pretrial, she was there with this case for an entire year, but she didn't preside over guilt innocence, and now she comes back for punishment. For her particular case, we apply a different abuse. We apply a different standard of review. I don't think you can move the standard of review around. I think that
you're not changing the standard of review, but it's a question of how you apply that standard of review. If the judges weren't in the position that the rule presumes that they were, aren't you creating a presumption that's a false presumption?
No, because I think that it's still an abuse of discretion, but maybe you're looking at what her error was, if that makes sense.
Certainly raises the question of the wisdom of trying a case in that fashion, and
yes.
maybe courts may rethink that practice if the rule is applied differently.
I think it is. It was certainly an unusual posture for a case, and I haven't ever had one that I came across which had quite so many judges in it. But I think the thing we need to keep in mind is that Judge Beach did sit through all of pretrial, was familiar with all the multiple discovery disputes that were going on. And then she does sit and gives, I think the thing that's important to remember too, is that she gives the defense the opportunity during this post-trial hearing. She says, well, let's bring Mom back and y'all can show me how you would have impeached her. And the defense didn't think that was going to be convincing to her and didn't utilize that. And so this idea that it would have been, if it wasn't going to convince the trial judge, how are you going to show that it would have convinced the jury? There was an opportunity to develop that in the record and to develop it before Judge Beach, before she made her decision, and they didn't do it. And I think what Judge Beach relied on was the fact that I can look at this officer's testimony, I can look at this offense report, and I can see that it's copy-paste. And I think when you look at two documents that are literally identical and say...
You think you can effectively cross-examine a witness from indirect testimony as opposed from their own handwritten statement? You think the effect of that is anywhere close to being the same?
I think in this scenario it is. I wouldn't say that that's a rule that you can say across the board. I think that certainly there are instances where impeaching with your handwritten statement is going to be a lot more effective. This case, I think, has a unique posture because you have a police officer who comes in and he was the one that she allegedly made the statement to. And he says, she never made that statement to me. If she did, I would have written it down. And I wouldn't have done it that way because I'm trained not to do it that way. And I think that is, the issue we have here is that is a very effective impeachment. And so she is effectively impeached, and that is before the jury. And so this idea that if we had a different impeachment or if we had the same impeachment on the same issue with her handwritten statement, that would have swayed the jury, I don't think that that's a valid argument in the end.
I've got a Brady question. You mentioned just a second ago, and I don't want to take what you said out of context or get it wrong if I'm stating what you said wrong, but it sounded like you said Watkins made it very obviously that we're under materiality now. We're not doing Brady. I assume you don't mean that Brady doesn't apply in Texas in criminal jurisprudence. It still does.
Yes.
You agree? And obviously, constitutional jurisprudence, you have the Constitution, and the states can be more stringent than the Constitution, but they obviously can't be more liberal. And so we have Brady, which deals with exculpatory evidence and the state's duties to turn that over. And then you have Michael Morton Act, and then you have now materiality definition, and that applies to this statutory scheme. And obviously, trial courts, appellate courts still, you would concede, have the ability in a situation where there wasn't evidence that was produced that was exculpatory, potentially, to analyze that under Brady.
Yes, so I think the issue is that if you're going to make a Brady, if we're going to argue under Brady, they needed to make the Brady claim, and we've only made a 3914 claim.
Are you certain of that? It's a constitutional claim. Does it have to be brought up, or is it one of those types of errors that you don't even have to preserve, that it could be looked at for the first time upon appellate review? Do we have the capacity, if If they didn't object under Brady, do you think that we could analyze it under Brady?
I think that no. So I'm not 100% sure as to the case law, but I'm pretty sure. So, for example, there are lots of constitutional claims that can be waived. So if you have a Crawford violation and you don't make the objection, you've waived it. And here they never made a Brady objection at trial. They only objected under 3914, and then that's the objection that they pursued throughout the course of this appeal as well. So I don't think that we can now just drop in a Brady analysis because everyone's pursued this as if it is under 3914. 3914, when we look at A and when we look at H, compare it to Brady, what Watkins says about 3914 is that it is forward-looking. So A is you need to disclose every document they ask for if it's remotely relevant. You need to give it. And H says if it is relevant to the punishment or to the conviction, you need to disclose it, but forward-looking. And so you could have a scenario where you're sitting here pre-trial and you think, wow, this document really is, you know, potentially exculpatory depending on what comes out at trial. And so you disclose it under 3914H, but then trial goes on, it ends up taking a totally different track, and the issue never becomes relevant. Brady would not have required you to disclose that because Brady looks in hindsight and says, what happened at trial? H is forward-looking. But you could have the flip side where if you were looking pre-trial, you never would have thought this issue comes up, kind of in our scenario. We never would have thought that mom was going to lie on the stand. And now, post-trial, you have a 3914H post-trial duty to disclose, and you have a Brady duty to disclose.
Let me ask you something, and forgive me because this is something I haven't looked at in preparing for today. This was something in the past, and I believe it was a component to this case way back when. It hasn't been discussed much today, but I think at some point one of the arguments that the state made was that that this wasn't even adequately requested, and that there wasn't the proper motion. What is the state's position on that? At some point, obviously, some criminal practitioners got in a habit of just filing a letter request, not even a motion, not even a movement of the court. I've always believed that was sufficient for under Brady, but obviously Michael Morton kind of changed that, so a lot of practitioners started kind of incorporating them into one document. Do you believe it was adequately requested, and if not, why?
It's not adequately requested under A, but I do think we can see that it needed to be disclosed under H, if that makes sense. So we made the argument, A basically says, if you want it and it's relevant, you have to make a request for it, and it needs to be a specific request. The letter that we received in this case was a generic, give me all your documents request, and the case law is pretty clear that that's not sufficient under A to trigger the state's duty to disclose. Then they did file a motion that listed specific documents, but the problem was that the order that went with the motion was never signed. And there's also case law that says the motion without a signed order to accompany it is also not sufficient under 3914A to trigger the duty to disclose. And so we do not have an A request. That's where the remand on this case is a bit confusing because the CCA, I think, was confused in saying reconsider in light of 3914A because this has never been, I don't think that the initial court reviewed this under A, and I don't think that we have ever presented this as A being the big debate in this case.
Have you seen, just in trying to figure out what's going on here, not that this would normally be relevant, but it is to me now, have you seen, since you have a position at the district attorney's office as an appellate attorney, a lot of these remands where they're saying exactly the same thing, consider this in light of 3914A?
Not in light of 3914. I haven't. Okay. I don't think we've gotten a lot of things. We have. This is the only case
you haven't seen that in mass. On this as if it's like boilerplate, basically. Yeah. You haven't seen that.
No, and I don't think that the CCA nor does these kind of boilerplates as a matter of course. But I think that they assumed that because we brought up Watkins, that we were looking at it as a 3914A case. And it wasn't really, they weren't really trying to distinguish between A and H at the time that we were presenting oral argument there. And the timing of that case was a little weird too, because we were set to argue at the snowstorm in February, and then obviously they said, never mind, it's snowing. And then Watkins came out, and then they set our oral argument. And so we said, hey, I think everything has changed in light of Watkins. And so I think there was a bit of a kind of crossways at the CCA thinking, oh, if you're talking about Watkins, you must be talking about 3914A. Because Watkins is is a 3914A case, but they do make comments about 3914H, and Watkins does, I think, completely remove 3914A as a whole out of a constitutional Brady analysis into a strictly statutory criminal discovery scheme. They're very clear about that. If there are no further questions, then I would concede the rest of my time to the court and ask, obviously, that the trial court, or that this court, uphold the trial court's ruling.
Thank you.
One of the things that strikes me when we have these 3914 cases, and the court noted it on their original opinion in this case, is that I find alarming that the 3914 is supposed to be a sweeping change in discovery, but yet we're having to fight constantly. And there's a footnote in the original opinion that talks about how this was a constant battle to just obtain discovery in this particular case. And that's another reason why I think to diminish the impeachment value of the statement and the importance of it, and that, oh, well, the cop, the defense called the cop, and so that sufficiently sufficed, sort of offends my notion of justice, I'll put it that way, because why are we relegated to secondary impeachment when they have the evidence, they're required to give it to us, and they don't? And now we're going to nitpick and say, okay, well, because you did something to try to prove that the woman was lying, that's okay. And in fact, even the prosecutor on the record starts arguing, well, they can't show harm from the very beginning that the 3914 violation is urged. And it's urged before trial, during trial, in punishment, all the way through, which this court did take specific note of.
Ms. Mullen, real quick.
Yes.
I hate to throw you off, but
no, that's fine.
You just said required to give it to us. That they were required to give it to us. Obviously, that's your position.
Correct.
Talk about that a little more.
Why they're required to give it to
yeah.
us? Under A, obviously, in my opinion, I do think that the request was made properly. This court actually found that below. And also, under H, it's clearly Brady material. It's clearly impeachment material. And it's an extraneous offense that they offered into evidence. They know there's more there than a decor. They had the case file. They had the probable cause affidavit from the police officer that could have shown the cop exactly what he said and swore to under oath, which would at least have helped him say, she never said that. And I totally disagree with the impression left with the jury by the state is that you don't remember this, and that's why you're conflicting with her testimony. So I think they had an absolute duty under Brady without 3914 altogether. But now we're in the 3914 area, particularly with all the other issues, all the other violations of 3914 that I raised originally in my brief. And I would like to point out to the court, did that answer you, Judge?
It does, but remind us, the court, assume we know nothing, when it comes to Brady, do you have to have a motion with a ruling in order to get those materials?
No.
In 3914, Michael Morton stuff, do you have to have a motion and a ruling to get that information?
Under H, no. Under A, yes. But that's not mitigating evidence. That's not Brady evidence.
Okay. Let me go back to one of Justice Walker's previous questions.
Okay.
Can a Brady violation be raised for the first time on appeal?
I don't believe so. And, well, under certain circumstances. I'm gonna give a caveat. I know there's certain circumstances then you can, because in writs it happens. There was a due process argument made in this case at the very end of the arguments, but it was mostly a 3914 argument under H. If that helps.
And going back to the concept of having multiple judges in the trial court at different stages, if the trial court making the decision is relegated to reading the record, is the trial court in any better position to decide this case than we are?
No. Not in my opinion. And it is a sort of an alarming precedent that's being set with various judges sitting on cases as a litigant in court. Obviously, I'm concerned about that. We're here about justice and trying to do the right thing. And I think it's extremely important when you make rulings that you have heard the evidence, particularly if we're going to suppose deference.
It's real commonplace for in Tarrant County, it's where they pick the jury.
Correct.
And then a different judge tries the case.
Correct.
Not as common to have one do guilt, innocence, and one do punishment.
Correct, but with the growing number of magistrates we're having, we're seeing it happen more. And I don't think it helps the justice system as a whole. It's unfortunate, in my opinion. One last thing I would like to add is that there's numerous issues. The court originally decided harm under just the statement. However, if the court were to totally disavow that, which I can't imagine, but there's been some questions, I'd ask that the court be sure to address all of the various 3914 violations that I discuss and ask for and raise in my brief.
And you're talking about not just the other things that you mentioned.
All the other stuff, yes, correct. And that's it. Do you have any other questions?
Did you have anything?
That's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Your case has been submitted. And